Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell, sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, science, and metaphysics that might offer just the knowledge you've been looking for to enhance your life. Today, we'll take a look at two books on effective leadership. The first is The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, published in 1989 by Dr. Stephen Covey, and second, Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win, published in 2015 by Navy SEALs Jocko Willink and Leif Babin. Well, first, who is Dr. Stephen Covey? He was the chairman of the Covey Leadership Center and also the Institute for Principle-Centered Leadership. He taught personal and organizational leadership development around the world. He once shared that he got so turned on by the idea of training leaders that it became his whole life's mission. He emphasized the difference between tasks that are urgent but not important, important but not urgent, and every permutation of the two, because he found that's what's accepted as common sense isn't always common practice in the business world. As a young parent, Dr. Covey was very concerned about his son's lack of success in school and sports and how it was affecting his self-esteem. He began years of research on what makes some people successful, and eventually he became known around the country for his work in leadership development. What he recognized is his way of trying to help his son was not in harmony with the way he perceived his son, because he perceived his son as inadequate and not capable. So the first thing that had to shift was his perception to see his son as one with unique layers of potential that would be realized at his own speed. So he began to affirm, enjoy, and value his son. Dr. Covey explains the fundamental principles of human effectiveness by looking at our individual life model, our perceptions, assumptions, or frame of reference. It's the way we see the world, understand it, and interpret it, like looking at a map, also called a paradigm, that defines for us how things are or the way we think they should be anyway, based on our values. When we enter college, we each have our own idea of how the world works, but by the time we graduate, our paradigm has likely changed due to our interactions with the different teachers, the classes, and experiences. You know, the more we take responsibility for our paradigm, we examine and test it occasionally against reality, and a larger and far more objective reality comes into view. Covey believes that we can only achieve quantum improvements in our lives when we take a good look at our attitude and behavior and see if it needs adjustment. It's called a paradigm shift. We shift when we get new information, and we see any issue in a totally different light. Covey found many principles at work that help us live in harmony in society, and these principles don't change because they're embedded in society. For example, fairness is a principle, and it's the context for justice, how justice is developed. There's a vast difference in how fairness is defined and achieved, but there's almost a universal awareness that people believe in fairness. Other principles are integrity, honesty, human dignity. What is excellence, and how do you define potential growth? When we value these principles, we have a knowledge of things as they are, and the principles are guidelines for our conduct, and they're fundamental to our personal effectiveness. If we attempt to shortcut any of these, it undermines our goals, and when we're not being fair with people, they can feel manipulated, and it can destroy our trust. Albert Einstein observed, "The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." That's why Covey's program is called an inside-out approach to personal effectiveness. It all starts within, the most inside part of ourselves, our character, our motives. You know, if we want to be happy in a marriage, we have to be the kind of person that generates positive energy, be more understanding, and then we become more trustworthy. In his experience examining the success of thousands of people, Covey is confident that the seven habits he describes are already deep within us, and we just have to recognize which ones need a little more development and maybe increase our knowledge about it. There's an old maxim that says, sow a thought, reap an action. Sow an action, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. And sow a character and reap a destiny. Yes, habits are that powerful because we're consistent in expressing our character in both our effectiveness or ineffectiveness. It's like habits that have gravity that keep them stuck to us. If our habits include procrastination, you know, it takes some willpower to change. But once we break out of a negative habit, it takes life in a whole new dimension. Covey explains what he calls the maturity continuum. It begins when we're infants, totally dependent on others, and then years later we're more independent physically, mentally, emotionally, and financially to the point where we are able to take care of ourselves. So as we grow and mature, we become aware of all of nature is interdependent, just as our relationships with others are interdependent. You know, I have to say right now in my life, our neighbors are very important to us. My husband will be having some surgery at the end of the month, and I recently retired to be at home with him more. Our neighbors watch out for us, and in fact, they help fix our sprinkler systems when they go haywire, making sure we get our garbage cans out of time. And our neighbors have taken time to make an incredibly beautiful flower garden between our homes. And so for all this, when they want to take a frequent trip in their motorhome, we're always happy to feed their cats. That's interdependence. Okay, the first three habits Covey calls private victory habits. If you're open to embodying these three habits, your personal growth will be evolutionary. Your self-confidence will skyrocket. Your relationships will improve, and you'll feel more creative. Habit number one is to be proactive, to be responsible for your own life, along with the initiative and responsibility to make things happen. Proactive people are not reactive, but when some disturbance happens, a proactive person doesn't let it stop them from making a decision on how to act. Eleanor Roosevelt once observed, "No one can hurt you without your consent." Our basic character does not have to be hurt at all. But if we're reactive, our response to a disturbance might be, "There's nothing I can do. It's somebody else's fault." While a proactive person might respond with, "There's got to be an alternative here somewhere. I wonder if there's a different approach." Habit number two is to begin with the end in mind. This is based on the principle that all things are created twice. First, in our mind, as an idea, a mental image, and then it's followed by a physical creation. So habit number one was personal leadership. Habit number two is management. How can I best achieve my goal? Habit number three is put first things first. It's updating my to-do list every day, and it includes time management, organizing myself, and getting my priorities straight. I don't know about you, but I can find myself spending time in urgent and important tasks, like this radio program. Urgent but not important tasks, like taking calls or going to meetings that aren't that important. Not urgent but important tasks, like analyzing new opportunities. Or not urgent, not important, trivia, time wasters, busy work. There's a lot of stories in this book about these first three private victory habits, and they're used in good and unfortunate experiences. So I hope you get the book and enjoy those parts. Well, the next fourth, fifth, and sixth habits are public victory habits. Number four is think win-win. It's about how we interact with each other. We're constantly seeking mutual benefits in our interactions and negotiations. So when everyone feels good about the decision and we're all committed to the action plan, that's win-win. We build successful projects together. But there are alternatives that you've probably seen happen in your life, like I win, you lose. It's very dysfunctional and does not lead to cooperation. Or I lose, you win. Oh, have it your way. I give up. Yeah, you know where that goes. Or win only. Regardless, I get what I want. Or lose, lose, nobody wins. So to get to win-win, it's to separate the people from the problem. Focused on their interests, not on their positions. Invent options, brainstorm for mutual gain. Insist on both parties winning. It's a great habit when you're negotiating anything, but especially if you're buying something expensive like a house, you want it to be win-win. Habit number five is seek first to understand and then be understood. When there's a problem, there's often a tendency to rush in and try and fix things without first taking the time to figure out what the problem really is. So seek first to understand. It's very effective in our interpersonal communication. Why? Because, you know, most people don't listen with the intent to understand. They're listening with the intent to reply to us. So when another person is talking, we're either totally ignoring them or listening at one of four levels. Pretending to listen. Yeah, okay. Selective listening, hearing only certain parts that we care about. Attentive listening, paying attention on the words that are said. But the highest form of listening is empathic listening. Listening with the intent to understand, to see their frame of reference, how they see the world, how they feel. Empathic listening lifts the other person up. The last of the public habits is number six, synergize. This is where the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Covey writes about a personal experience when the employees of his company went on a weekend trip to a mountain retreat center with the goal of creating a new corporate mission statement for the business. At first, communication was very respectful, very careful, very predictable, but as they talked about alternatives, opportunities, they became very open, very excited, authentic. They started thinking out loud. These were the ideas that moved the group from mutual respect to creating some synergistic level of communication. It was so exciting, and each person felt they participated in creating the new mission statement. I had that same experience when I served on a board, so it's important to contribute to the discussion and not hold back. Help flush out all the possibilities. The last habit, number seven, is called sharpen the saw. This habit makes all the others possible. It's preserving and enhancing the greatest asset that we have, which is ourself. To continue to be highly effective, it's important to renew our physical, spiritual, mental, and emotional areas in life. To live in a wise and balanced way. It's the most single powerful investment we can make, investing in ourselves. Physically, it means taking care of our physical body. Spiritually, it is to draw upon those sources that inspire us and lift us up, that strengthen us. Mentally, it means continued education, exposing our minds to those great minds throughout history, continuing to expand so that we don't narrow our mind. And emotionally, it comes from our friendships, our family, and talking with others and listening. So there you have it, highlights of the seven habits of highly effective people. Now, Covey includes many, many stories and experiences he had while researching this, and they are absolutely delightful to read. But at the end of the book, he shares a beautiful quote by George Bernard Shaw, who said this, "This is the true joy in life, being used for a purpose recognizing by yourself as a mighty one, being a force of nature instead of some fervish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, and complaining that the world will not devote itself to making me happy. You can just hear his voice. He said, I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it's my privilege to do it wherever I can. I want to thoroughly be used up when I die. For the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. It's sort of a torch which I've got to hold up for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. I so appreciate Dr. Covey for bringing this valuable work to the world. You know, KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running extremely well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805. Or look for the donate button on the website. And we also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through the website careasy.org. And if you have any questions, hey, give us a call. 1-855-500-7433. The second book I really like about the qualities of effective leaders is Extreme Ownership, How U.S. Navy SEALs Lead and Win, written by Jocko Willink and Leif Babin, both Navy SEAL leaders. They were in Task Unit Bruiser, and when it returned from a successful mission to the city of Ramadi in Operation Iraqi Freedom, they reflected on what they learned, and they rewrote the SEAL Leadership Training Manual for the next generation of leaders. They realized that the principles critical to SEAL team leaders and their successes on the battlefield was having trained and prepared their leaders, how they molded and developed high-performance teams, and how they lead in combat. It's all directly applicable to the success of any group, whether you're in an organization, a corporation, or just plain life. When they retired, they launched a company called Echelon Front to teach these leadership principles to businesses and Fortune 500 companies. The book is not a glorified war story. It's about their team, Task Unit Bruiser. For when a team works together, the sum is greater than its parts. We just heard that from Dr. Covey, didn't we? Well, for the SEALs, the only meaningful measure of a leader is whether the team succeeds or fails. Obviously, it's in war. And for all the definitions, descriptions, and characterizations of leaders, there's only two that matter. Is the leader effective or ineffective? Effective leaders lead successful teams that accomplish their mission and win. Ineffective leaders don't. The best leaders are not driven by ego or personal agendas. They're focused on the mission and how best to accomplish it. You know, in many ways, combat reflects the life of a business. It's only amplified and intensified because every decision has immediate consequences and everything is at stake. Military personnel must believe in the cause they're fighting for. They must believe in the plan that they're asked to execute and believe in and trust the leader they're asked to follow. The leaders must own everything. There's no one else to blame. The book is divided into three parts. Number one, winning the war within to create a mindset necessary to lead and win. Number two, the laws of combat, the four critical concepts that enable a team to perform at their highest level. And number three, sustaining victory, how to maintain that edge, how to keep the team perpetually operating at a high level. In each chapter, they identify a leadership lesson they've learned. Then they explain the leadership principle and demonstrate its application in the business world. Chapter one opens with details about the first major Ramadi operation that Jocko led. At one point, he realized, you know, things are not adding up. We seem to be dissolving into chaos. So back at base, he gathered information, and as the team was debriefed, it was obvious many serious mistakes were made by many people. beginning with the planning phase through the execution phase. Plans were altered, but they didn't share them with each other. Communication was ambiguous. Radio procedures were confusing. Their friends, the Iraqi army, changed their plan but didn't tell Team Unit Bruiser. Timelines were pushed without clarification. The location of friendly forces wasn't shared, so you can see on and on and on. It was a bit of chaos. For Jocko, the more he reviewed the problems, it felt like something was missing. The truth wasn't coming out. Who was to blame? Then it hit him. There was only one person to blame for everything that had gone wrong. It was him. When the investigators arrived to debrief the whole unit, one by one, team members stood up, and so many of them took blame. But then Jocko stood up. He said, "Stop. I'm responsible for the whole operation." And he took ownership of everything that went wrong. The result was the commanding officer had now greater trust in Jocko. The troops respected him even more. So principle number one, the leader must own everything in their world, acknowledge mistakes and failures, take ownership, and develop a plan to win. That's extreme ownership. It requires leaders to look at an organization's problem without emotional attachment. The leader sets their ego aside and works to build an effective team. The leader doesn't take credit for the success, but bestows that on his subordinates and his team members. And in effect, that mindset filters into every level of the team's culture. In their consulting company, Echelon Front, when they're hired to diagnose why a business is having problems, first they talk to as many employees and often contractors as necessary to identify where the problems occurred and examine the details of the leader's plan. When they meet with the leader regarding their findings, they first ask the leader why they thought things went wrong. And you can imagine the typical response. Oh, it's someone else. It's so-and-so. It's some department. It's whatever. Jocko then says, kindly, "Those may be factors, but there's one important reason why this plan failed, and it's you. You are to blame." Well, obviously, then the team leader protests, and Jocko says, "Wait a minute." The leader's mind, they had assumed they were doing everything right, so when things went wrong, their ego had to blame others. So he asks, "Do you, the leader, think your employees were blatantly disobedient?" "No." "Do you, the leader, think the employees were sabotaging the project?" "No." Jocko said, "On the battlefield, a leader doesn't blame others. If a unit doesn't do what he needed it to do, he was to blame for not giving clear instructions. If the machine gunner engaged targets outside of his field of fire, he was to blame that the gunner didn't understand where his field of fire was. If the enemy unexpectedly surprises them, then he was to blame for not thinking through all the possibilities, no matter what." Jocko could never blame others when a mission went wrong, and in the end, it's all about the mission. How can you get your team to effectively execute a plan in order to accomplish the mission successfully? That is the question. In the SEAL units, it's almost always the leader's attitude that determines if they succeed or fail. If the leader blames the training staff, inadequate equipment, whatever, refusing to accept responsibility, the result is poor performance and mission failure. Then subordinates and team members turn around and blame everyone else down the line, and eventually the team is ineffective and unable to properly execute a plan. When things are going wrong as a leader, it's not what you preach, it's what you tolerate. If substandard performance is accepted and no one's held accountable, then poor performance becomes the new standard. Principle number two is to believe. The leader must believe in the mission and share whatever information is needed for the team to believe. A lack of belief in the goal undermines their ability. So in chapter two, it's called "No Bad Teams, Only Bad Leaders." In SEAL training, there's a period called Hell Week, where trainees are engaged in daily boat crew races. For each race, the instructor gives the boat crew leaders detailed and intentionally complicated instructions, like paddle your boats through the surf, dump the boat, move the boat, carry the boat back to the beach, run up the hill with the boat over your head, then go here, go there, finish here. Just as they get that said to the boat team leaders, he says, okay, ready, set, go. And Jocko reflected, in one particular hell week of races, one boat crew dominated the competition. It was boat crew two. They won nearly every race. They had a strong leader who seemed highly motivated, performed well. And he noticed the crew was might have been cold and exhausted, but they were always smiling. At the same time, boat crew number six placed dead last in virtually every race. Instead of working it as a team, they were, you know, furious and frustrated with each other and grumpy and unhappy. And every time they got back at the end of the race, they were really unhappy because they were the losers. They were given some things to do. So it was really funny. At one point, the senior chief said, hey, let's switch these two boat crew leaders. Let's have the best boat crew leader get the worst team and vice versa. Well, it was the last race of the day when they did this, and all the instructors were on the beach with floodlights and flashlights waiting to see what happened. And wasn't it a miraculous turnaround? Boat crew six went from last to first, and boat crew two was right behind them, which proves that leadership is the single greatest factor in any team's performance. Boat crew two's team had high respect for each other. And that became a habit, no matter who their leader was. So there's so much in this book that I found important to me, such as never be satisfied. Keep it simple. Sometimes plans can be too complex. And there's one thing I used a lot in my career, explaining the why, W-H-Y. Why are we doing this? Why are we taking on this project? Why are we doing it this way? And it's really important in achieving the results you want because everyone's focused on the why. And everyone on the team has a sense of pride when that project is done. I've also done this before, tackled too many things at once and feel overwhelmed. Yeah, I got to get out my to-do list again, reprioritize. What's the highest priority at this moment? Develop a solution. Seek input from the team, and then we execute together. And then if our priorities shift, we reprioritize all over again. So I hope you've enjoyed hearing about the principles and practices of being an effective leader. Use it for good in your life and the lives of everyone you love. And for those you don't love, use it for their good anyway. It's another small step in bringing peace to the world. And the music I've chosen for this show is from an acoustical guitar CD by the Lemming Shepherds called Symphony for the Senses. And it comes with a full-color booklet on their many adventures. So right now, until next week, may peace be with you.